Hello, welcome to The REPL, a podcast diving into closure programs and libraries. This week, I'm talking about YAMLScript with Ingi.net, the creator of YAML and YAMLScript. Welcome to the show, Ingi.
Thank you, Daniel. It's really good to be here, and been a long time coming, but I'm glad to finally be doing this talk with you.
Yeah, me too. We've been talking about this for quite a few months, I think, at this point, but excited to explore something which is kind of a project that sort of blew my mind when you first told me about it. And that's YAMLScript, but yeah, I'm excited to talk about this and hear more about what you've been working on. So there's kind of the past Ingi and then the present Ingi, and I think both are pretty interesting. So maybe to start though, can you tell us a bit about like what you've been doing before, where you've come from, and particularly your background with YAML? Because I kind of assumed, I guess I'd never really thought about where YAML came from, like JSON, Douglas Crockford, kind of somewhat well-known sort of story of where that came from. And YAML, I guess in my mind, yeah, I never really thought too much. I just kind of always thought, oh, it was always there almost because, you know, when I started programming, YAML was sort of already pretty well established. But of course, somebody had to create it. It didn't come out of nothing. So tell us a bit about YAML and your role in creating it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. I will start in 2001, that's when YAML actually started. There's three people involved, Oren, Clark, and myself. And it actually started about probably a year before that with Clark and Oren being on this SML mailing list, which is simplifying XML. And I have the archive of the mailing list. It's quite a read. And I should mention at that point that all of YAML was developed the first 5 years over email only. We did meet in person once for a week in the middle, but it was all over email. So Clark and Oren just got fed up with the XML talking about it and decided to go a different direction. Clark was a big Python guy, so he just made up something that looked like Python. In the meantime, I was working in Vancouver, BC for a company called ActiveState, and they were grabbing onto everything open source and figuring out how to make money out of it, pretty much. And another thing that ActiveState did was put Perl on Windows, and I was kind of a Perl guy back then. So I got myself a job up there. And I was sitting next to the top Python programmers, a lot of interplay there. So I wrote a serialization language for Perl called DataDenter. It was a module, and it would serialize any data out. And it kind of looks like YAML, you know, it was indented. Anyway, and there's some random person saw both Clark and Oren's stuff going on, and they saw my DataDenter, and they said, you guys should talk to each other. And that's all the guy said. And I got on the phone with Clark, and we talked for 4 hours probably, and I was fully sold. And I love the name YAML. I just kept saying YAML, YAML, YAML as I walked around the office for the next 6 months, you know. But and at that point, I was really into going to open source conferences and meetups and that kind of thing. So I signed up to give a talk in 2001, like 2 months after I found out about this YAML thing, thinking how hard is this going to be at OSCON. I think three people came to the talk. One of them was the founder of Zope, though. Zope was this, Z-O-P-E was this big deal back in that day. It was some fantasy web creation thing. I don't know how to describe it exactly. But anyway, the guy had a couple good ideas and he was encouraging. And so I continued on. It took us about 4 years to get a spec out, but we started putting out implementations as we were going. The Ruby community really kind of picked up on it. And Ruby was a really young language at that point. Rails wasn't invented yet. And they just kind of ran with it, and they liked it, started using it in all of their projects, and shipped YAML with their core distribution of the language. And so I think that, you know, I never know. I've kind of been a language guy making up these little languages, some of which have had some popular. I think I wrote the first JavaScript templating language in 2006, and it was compiled, and somebody built a couple companies around it back then. But, you know, it didn't become a household word. I think YAML kind of has in programmer households anyway. But I didn't really have anything to, you know, besides giving my talks, and some things get lucky and some things don't. So, and then it continued on. We put out a couple specs that kind of Clark and Oren, we got burnt out around 2006 and, you know, pushed on through 2009, and they kind of dropped out. And I just have always been fascinated by finishing what we did. I mean, if you think about XML, it has the transformation language, the schema languages, all the bits that kind of flesh it out as a full platform. And YAML always intended to have those kind of things, but didn't. And I've been thinking about that and trying to start efforts for that for a long time. And I have to say, kind of leading up to talking about YAMLScript in a bit, YAMLScript seems like it can answer about 90% of everything I wanted to do with YAML. So I'm very excited about this.
Nice. There's something on your website called ECMIism.
Talking about the ingi.net website?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I think this kind of infuses a lot of, you know, the different projects that you work on. So do you want to tell people what is ECMIism and why do you think it's valuable?
Yeah, I'd like to. ECMIism is a term that I started throwing around 2008, 2009. And the honest truth is that I own these ECMIism.com and OregonNet domains, and I was going to do something with them, and then I decided I didn't. But I felt like I had this philosophy of I'd love to create modules, and I have over 200 packages for Perl, and I've published packages to multiple languages. So I loved kind of out of that active state era doing things in multiple languages. And ECMIism was this idea that if you're going to create a module or a library, it's just an idea encapsulated in code, right? So, and all languages kind of have the same needs and want to do the same things. So like a really successful natural language author, a book author is going to have their stuff. They're not going to do it themselves, but they'll have it published in every language they can if it's a really popular book.
Right.
I had this idea that I knew was pretty much impossible, but I wanted every idea that I came with that I could abstract as a module, as a library, which is what I always did, to be available in every language possible. And so ECMIism was this dream that someday, every time you had an idea, it could be instantly available for almost as much effort in every language. If you come back to that later, I can tell you that I think I have a way to actually pull this off in the next year or so.
Cool. All right. So that brings us more or less to today with some other bits in between, of course. But this is a closure podcast primarily. While I enjoy talking to you about YAML, you know, I don't generally talk about non-closure things on the podcast. So what is the relevance to closure programmers, in particular of YAML script?
That's a great question, and I'll answer it short and then longer. Zero relevance to closure programmers. I don't think they could care less. They don't like YAML. They use it when they have to because they have to. But let's back up a little. So I came up with the idea of YAML script summer 2022. I'm like, this would be great if I could have data and, you know, evaluate code and that kind of thing in it. And I knew it had to be a Lisp. I didn't really know what a Lisp was. I knew what a Lisp was, parentheses with a function in the front and args after that. That's all I knew. The end of the year came around and I'm like, okay, I want to really get into this. I need to learn what a Lisp is. So I Googled, how do you make a Lisp? I figured I had to make one. And I found a project on GitHub called Make a Lisp. No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And this project's amazing. It gives you 11 chapters of things that you have to do to make this Lisp. And it starts off by saying it's a closure-based Lisp. And I didn't even know what closure was. I didn't even know how to pronounce it. I'm like, a closure-based Lisp. I'm like, okay. So I started doing the exercises. I decided to do it in Perl because I didn't really want to fight. There was already an implementation in Perl. In fact, there's an implementation in over 75 languages, if you can believe that. And some had duplicates already, so I just did another pro one. It took me about 2 weeks to get through the whole thing. For every chapter, you have to pass a sweat of test suite for that chapter. So you can't really move on until you pass that test suite. And then at the end, they had actually written MAL, Make a Lisp. That's what they call their language. In MAL, and you had to run their code using your MAL interpreter to pass the test suite. And it was mind-bending. It still is a little mind-bending. But I got done with that, and I'm like, okay, this closure thing, I kind of like it. And it looks like I like some of the design decisions about closure, the fact that it's not all parentheses, right? That he realized that, you know, by that time, JSON had been around, and it's like, yeah, let's use curly braces and square brackets and not have everything looking visually the same. Oatmeal with fingernail clippings, as Larry Wall, the Perl inventor, once said. About Lisp with John McCarthy in the audience, and he didn't know it. So I decided, and I'm not kidding, that I would finish Closure, make a full implementation in Perl. And I was actually helping to organize a Perl conference in Toronto that summer. So I'm like, I'll give a talk on it. And I got pretty far. And it was called Lingi, and it was meant to be a Perl-hosted Closure. And
wow.
Yeah, it got pretty far along. I mean, it was actually running. I got about a tenth of the Closure core library working under it and that kind of stuff. So I hadn't actually written any Closure except for the Closure I was actually implementing myself up to this point. So now we're in July of last year And do you know Peter Stromberg, the Calva?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was another accident of fortune. I mentioned Java enclosure in my talk description for Lingi for this talk I was going to give. And the Perl conference was, you know, it's been declining every year. So it wasn't have anything to do with that. But it got picked up by some scrapers. And I got more hits than anybody else watching my video just because it had the words Java enclosure in the description. Yeah. So I was like, it took me a while to figure that out. One of the people that saw it was Peter. And he said, why don't you come over? I mean, he likes integrating stuff into Calva. So he's like, oh, I got to get this new closure variant working in Calva, I think was his thing. But it was more than just greed. He invited me in and was so kind. He's like, here are the channels you need to post to. Here are the people you need to meet. And we collabed for a week, and I got an NREPL communication working with Lingi, and we actually got something done. And then he kind of ghosted me and moved on to other stuff. So, I mean, no offense. He came to my two-hour talk at 3 in the morning his time and watched the whole dang thing a month ago. But, yeah, he introduced me to this great community, and I've never been in a more fantastic community of people. So I really appreciate Closure, its community. But I also realized as I'm doing this, I'm not giving to this community. I'm taking from it big time. So because I saw all of the pieces when I saw SCI and worked its engine. And when I saw GraalVM, I saw the blueprint of getting this out to every language by the end of the year. Now, I didn't. I've only got it out to 8 languages and we're well into the next year. But that hasn't changed at all. It's just, you know, time and work. It takes time. So the other interesting thing, though, is it actually does help Closure possibly, because let's think about this. There's probably 20 times more YAML users than Closure users. I don't know how many more times, but
probably more than that.
Right. It's like everybody has to deal with it. It's not like everybody in Closure loves it and they're supposed to be there, but everybody that uses YAML, you know, they kind of have to deal with it at some level, maybe. Some people like it, but, you know, some people hate it. I'm fine with that. So what I realized was, YAML scripts, this thing, compiles to Closure, and you can get, it doesn't look like Closure. You can make it look very much not like Closure. You can make it look actually very much like Closure too. It's kind of flexible that way. But if people want to do anything serious with it, they're going to have to learn Closure. So this could be a gateway that exposes a whole new group of people to Closure. And from my experience of looking on the net, it seems like at least some people think Closure's in its hit its peak and kind of going downhill. So I'm really hoping that YAML script might, if it takes off, that one of the benefits is that it really gets people interested in Closure.
Yeah. So this is a podcast and audio medium, but can you kind of describe, like, what is a YAML script file and compare it to, say, a YAML file, which people are maybe more familiar with?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll start off by saying, do you know that all JSON files are valid YAML?
I did know that. I've never taken advantage of it, but I was aware.
There's not much to take advantage of, but it's interesting. I guess there's some things that you could take advantage of. But all YAML config files are valid YAML script. Mm-hmm. And I made a conscious choice to do that. And when I say config files, what I mean is that there's some parts of YAML serialization that people never use in config files. You can define recursive pointers and that kind of thing. And you can use mappings and vectors as keys. And I know that you can do that in Closure as well, but nobody's going to do that in a config file, right? So basically anything that fits the JSON data model, which is almost in YAML, is a valid YAML script program. So we start with that. And we also make sure that when you load that or evaluate that with YAML script, that you don't execute any code that just happened to be something that is now valid code, right? You don't want to do that. You want to have it work exactly as it would if it was just plain YAML data. So the first secret of YAML script is that you start it with a tag. So YAML has this concept of tags, and nobody uses them, but they're a bang and then a word in front of any node, in front of any mapping sequence or scalar. So like instead of saying 1, 2, 3, you could say in without quotes, which becomes the number 1, 2, 3, you could say bang int, that would be the tag, in quotes 1, 2, 3, and it would load the same way. So at the top of a YAML file that you want to have things evaluated in, or at the top of a program that happens to be YAML script. So the YAML script kind of serves two different main purposes, embedding it in YAML and getting more out of YAML. And that's what I'm focusing on presenting it to the world as right now, or actually just writing programs in YAML and
Right.
Nobody but me really wants a new YAML-based programming language. So,
before we go too deep,
yeah,
I should have asked, what are people going to use YAML script for? Or what are people, where are the deficiencies in YAML that people might be able to take advantage of YAML script? And also, how do people solve these problems today? Because I'm aware of some, but you probably have a much wider perspective.
Sure. I would start off by saying I don't ever think about what are people going to do with my language too much. I mean, I know that I have to do that at some point to get it out, the word out, but I am trying to get the word out, and there are a number of specific problems that YAML scripts solves. One is that YAML files have to be all one file, and anybody that uses YAML seriously, like Ansible or Kubernetes or anybody that uses YAML in the large, they chose it because it was really tight and clean when they had these 20-line files, and now they have these 20,000-line files, and it's a gigantic mess, right? They have to make it composable. They have to be able to pull in other files and merge things and do all those manipulations. They also have to be able to interpolate certain values into strings. So YAML script, of course, is going to do all of those things. Its interpolation is fantastic, I think. Not only can you interpolate variables or symbols, you can interpolate expressions easily. You just say dollar open paren, whatever, YAML script expression, close paren, within any string. The other thing that's, this really shines about YAML over Closer, I would say, or almost every, so YAML has here documents, and they call them literal scalers, in that you can take any file, including any other YAML file, and encode it just by indenting it over to the appropriate place. That's a really powerful thing. I came across that in Perl, and also Shell has that. Other languages have approximations of that, but you can't really do, I mean, you can use double quotes in Closer, but you have to escape all the double quotes, right? I mean, there's no great way of doing that. And actually, in my tests are all YAML tests, because they actually, when I'm compiling stuff, I'm starting with a bunch of lines, and then it goes through seven layers of transformations to compile from YAML script to Closer. So testing each one of those is really easy when you have that kind of scalers. So going back, interpolation within those, you can basically have templates where you're just using dollar sign interpolation there. That's one. There's some deficiencies in YAML, like, do you know about anchors and aliases in YAML?
Not really. I've known the terms, okay. But...
So for any node, you can put, ampersand foo in front of a node. And you give that node a name, and later on, you can refer to that same node with asterisk foo.
Right.
Right. And so that seems like a great feature, and it is for serializing data, but when you're trying to organize your data and make reuse of certain parts, it seems like it'll be okay, but then it turns out to just not be that great. One thing is about YAML is that you can have multiple documents in a stream or a file separated by triple dashes.
You're right. Yep.
But you can't alias an anchor defined in a different document.
Right.
You know, things like that. But I can in YAML script. And it's not that I'm changing all YAML is YAML script is valid YAML. There's ways to change the rules. Going back to your question about what makes YAML script different than YAML. So all YAML script has to be valid YAML. But like, say you have the word say.
Mm-hmm.
And is say going to be the string say, or is it going to be the function say? Oh, say is my shorter form of print line, because I just can't be bothered to type seven letters just to say something. So. taken from other languages. So is that going to be data, or is it going to be a function symbol?
Right.
And I have this concept of modes, which maybe you've read about a bit mm-hmm. in YAML script. There's three modes, and there's really two modes. There's data mode and code mode. And you're constantly flipping back and forth between those when you're embedding YAML script inside of YAML. And data mode means that it's a string, and in code mode, it means it's a function. So anyway...
And so if I'm like an application developer and I want to use, I mean, we do use YAML in our configuration for various things, and we have quite a few YAML files because we want variants for different environments, we could instead switch to YAML script and write, you know, a few small functions in the places where we do want to sort of switch on these files and reuse the rest of it in a single file. I guess that's kind of the use case that comes to mind for me, is sort of getting a proper programming language rather than sort of like these sort of ad hoc templating solutions or places where you're kind of string replacing or doing various kind of hacky things, because it's, you know, it's a problem you need to solve, but it's not necessarily big enough one to like write a whole program for it, but there is some logic there that needs to be run. And so I guess in our case, we often will write some bash instead and make some changes that way, which, as you can imagine, sort of works, except when it doesn't. And so the idea of having a sort of real programming language, and especially Clojure programming language, is pretty interesting.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, basically, you can take your messy files and your bash scripts and hopefully throw out the bash scripts and retain the structures of your files, but refactor them over time. Go, oh, I use this in two places. I'll put that into another file, and then I'll just load that file where I need to. And one of the interesting things is you can pull in pieces of other files, right? So you have this other file, and then like, oh, I actually want this thing three levels down in this other file, but that's not a problem. So one thing I'd like to point out here is this, since it is a podcast, I think that YAML script code looks really clean, and I wouldn't have done it if it didn't. I started this project by taking that mal script that I talked to, that mal program, the implementation of this mini closure, and I just converted it to YAML and saw how it looked. And I'm like, oh, that's not going to work. So I like started shifting things around, and it got better and better and better. And now I think it's pretty darn slick, the amount of functionality that you get for the least syntax, which has always been kind of YAML's jam, right? Is like avoid the extra syntax if possible.
Nice. So we talked about YAML compiling to Clojure, but like what exactly is the sort of steps? How do we go from a YAML script file on disk to sort of some data structure in memory with a bunch of interpretation having happened? What does that look like, that pipeline?
That's a wonderful question. So people don't really understand this about YAML. So we call the taking of YAML data from text to a native data structure, as we call that a load. And other formats would call it a parse or maybe some other words. But for us, parse is one stage of a load. It's a very specific stage. It's actually the hardest to implement, right? But it is only one stage. So a YAML loader is at least four stages. I mean, you can break them down further into other stages. But the stages are, I'll break it into a few more. You read the data into code points. You take those code points, you break those into tokens. So that would be called read, scan. Then you parse those into what we call events. And events, there's only 10 types of events. Start mapping, stop mapping, start sequence, end sequence, start document, end document, start stream, which is this whole thing of multiple documents, end stream, scalar and alias. That's it. So after that, you take those events and you turn that into a tree. That's called composition or composing. I talked about tags earlier. Internally, even though nobody uses tags, every node has to be tagged as part of the load process. So we have to determine what's a string, what's an integer, what's a mapping. It's pretty simple for a normal data load, but we do assign those tags. Every YAML loader does that. After that, the final part is called construction, and that's the kind of language-specific thing. Okay, I have this fully tagged graph. How do I turn this into Ruby or Python or Rust or whatever language I happen to be using? So having implemented a full Clojure Lisp in this mal thing, I knew that it was really simple. You know, I just, to do Clojure, basically you tokenize stuff out. It has a really clean structure. You make an AST, which is really simple. And then you evaluate that AST and it produces another AST, and then you print that. So it's, you know, that's what REPL is, right? It's read, evaluate, print, and do it again, loop. So The YAML script compiler is a fancy YAML loader. It has the same stages with a couple extras added. So what I do is I parse, I take the YAML text and I create these events. I used an off-the-shelf one because that would take a year to write. That part was, and I used Snake YAML, which is the same one that CLJ YAML uses.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually worked with Andre quite a bit in the past. And so that's all written in Java. And so I just use that as a couple lines and I get the events back and then I take everything from there. So in YAML, you're not really allowed to consider a double quoted string different than a single quoted string. I mean, after you unescape it and all that, you can't really later on take the fact of, oh, this was originally a single quoted string, so I can do something different with that. In YAML script, I throw away those rules because I'm not loading into a data structure. I'm loading into an AST. I can use duplicate keys.
Right.
Because I'm not loading into something where it matters. I can say foo, say bar. Those are, you know, say colon foo, say colon bar. Those are duplicate keys.
Mm-hmm.
You can't load that into a data structure, but that's not what YAML script is doing. It's making an AST. So the next stage after that is called resolve, and that's where you assign tags to every node. So you parse, compose, resolve. Then I do this stage called build. And this is where I look at every side of a mapping pair and every scalar, basically, that is unquoted. And I consider that, okay, that's a piece of closure code, basically. And so I'm actually going to call another parser to break that into its components. After build, I have this thing called transpose. And this is where I'm going to put my own macro system in. And I've done it for a few things. You know the COND function?
Yep.
In YAML script, that behaves different than all the other functions. What I usually do is for a mapping pair, if I have A space B colon C space D, I basically take out the colon and put parens around it. So now I have paren A, B, C, D. But when you have cond, you really want to have the parens around A, B and another set of parens around C, D, right?
Right.
So there's a syntax for doing that, but then you have to remember that that applies to cond. So I just made cond do that. And it does it in this transform thing. It's like, oh, I'm going to rearrange the AST. But I also wanted to add that for users defining their own functions, they can get the YAML AST at that point and kind of like macros do in Closure, rearrange it and create a new AST. The next step is to take out all the YAML pairings and all that stuff. And that's called construction. So the constructor just basically makes a final Closure AST. And when I say Closure AST, I mean my own AST representing all of Closure. And then the last step to make it into code is you call print, and print's simple. It just walks that AST and prints just like a closer printer would, like a PR string or PR stir,
right?
That kind of thing. So that's it.
And you're printing like closure source code at that point.
Absolutely. 100% closure source code. I was thinking about this. You can't necessarily pass it into closure because I have different standard libraries.
Right.
So like you're not going to get say, for instance, out of the standard core one. But it is 100% closure code, yes. And I run it through Sci with the appropriate libraries loaded, and it evaluates perfectly.
Nice. But YAML script, you know, if you were to say that you needed to install a JVM to run YAML script, I feel like that would limit its appeal quite a lot. But of course, you don't. So tell us, what does this look like when it's actually running? What do people need? And how did you run closure without the JVM?
This is Babashka. And I only realized that a month ago. You know, Peter told me when Peter pulled me into the community, he's like, I'm like, because I actually consider myself a Bash expert. I like help people on Bash. I've created a whole uploading repository for called BPAN, you know, after CPAN. I've done insane stuff with Bash, written whole frameworks with it. And they're like, oh, we use Babashka here. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And I just ignored it. And then I started realizing that Bork Dude had all the answers I needed, but I still wasn't going to use Babashka. And it was only about a month or 6 weeks ago that I realized I was actually going to make a YAML script-based Babashka. You know, I was going to call it Yabashka or, you know, YB or something like that. And I realized I already have. So YS is the command line tool for, and it's almost exactly like BB. And it's actually using Sci under the hood and all the same things. And it's a standalone executable. It's compiled with GraalVM's native image, just like Babashka is. In fact, at some point when this settles down, like I have to give an open source summit talk in 2 weeks, and I'm just going to read through all of the Babashka source code and see all of it. I mean, it's basically a blueprint for what I can do with YAML script. But like you said, it's like a 20 millisecond startup time or something. It's as fast as Babashka, which is also extremely fast. So there's no, to answer your question, as you know, there's no JVM involved whatsoever.
Nice. And then we can maybe come back to ACMEism and how you get, you know, YAML script extended out into other languages. What does that look like?
Right. So from a YAML perspective, people know YAML as they have these config files and they have this programming language called Rust or something, or Ruby. Let's start with Ruby. And so they need to install a gem or a module or whatever they call it So they install YAML, and then they call YAML load, and that's it. I mean, YAML really only has two functions, dump and load, and nobody's ever used dump because they're just writing config files and loading them. So the way to present this to the YAML world was to make a YAML script library for every programming language, and it also has one function called load. Currently, I've done this. This is for 8 different languages now. I have a library that you can install just like you would, like for Closure, you would install it with Lion. Is it? Do you pronounce it Lion?
Yeah.
Or Lineagen, and use Maven for Java, or use NPM to install the node one, whatever. All of them are bindings. They're all about 100 lines long because they're just FFI bindings, foreign function interface bindings, to a compiled shared library. And to be honest, the biggest light bulb that went on for me, I've been looking for something like this for, I feel like, 20 years, is this perfect language to write shared libraries in. And so not only does GraalVM's native image compile to standalone binary executables, it compiles to standalone shared libraries. In every language, you write the stuff that has to be fast in C, create a shared library, and then bind it in. GraalVM just made, now I can use the same libyaml script, that's what it's called, libyaml script, and any language can bind to it. If I was a better C programmer, I'd be 20 languages in instead of 8 today, you know. But, and actually, we have 8 languages. I've only done 2 of them. One of the Clojurians made Ruby, Java, and Clojure bindings, and then some other people that I either met or friends who were interested made them for other languages, which is kind of nice because it's, I made the Python binding. I'm like, just make it like this. There's not much code there, so you can't really mess it up.
Right.
For ACMEISM, if you could generalize this process, so GraalVM's native image takes a jar file and turns it into a native binary shared library. Well, what's the best language to program a jar file in? I'll ask you.
I mean, I would use Clojure, I guess.
Yes, it's the best. It's Clojure's awesome. And to me, that's my biggest draw to, it's like a high-level language. It's amazing language. All the code I've written, it gets so tight. It's really nice. And it creates jar files, and these jar files can be turned into shared libraries. Now, going back to my ACMEISM point, I could come up with some idea, write it in Clojure, compile it to a shared library. And yeah. When I figure out, you're laughing, but this last part's the best. Also, in the summer of 2022, I created, do you know what NPM is for Node or Linux?
Yeah.
And you know what it is?
Yeah.
I created a wrapper for 42 languages.
Okay.
Because I knew this is the kind of thing that I would want to do. And I can't remember how to do anything in more than, I forget right away. Mm-hmm. So I actually wrote something called PST. It's on my GitHub account. And it's a command line wrapper where you just say PST release for any language and it just works, right? So, I mean, that's
right.
The idea.
Nice.
So, and if I make something that generates the bindings, then I just write some Clojure code and I'm like, yeah, ship it to 42 languages. That's ACMEISM. Realized. Thank you, Clojure.
So today, like, where is YAML script? Can people use it? What should they be using it for or not using it for?
Yeah, so I'll start with the story. I actually used a YAML script a couple of weeks ago to write a program to do this really annoying thing that I had to do on a regular basis, which was release YAML script versions. Because I had to release 8 different modules to 8 different languages, I had to build these, both the YS and the libyaml script binaries on 4 different platforms and upload these things. I had to edit all these changelog files. I had to tag things. And I just had a paper list, and I just would go through it every time. And I'm like, I'm going to write this in Bash. And I'm like, well, no, try writing it in YAML script. And I did. And it turned out to be so sweet. I mean, I'd say it's Babashka, but with a lot less of parentheses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so it's usable as a language that way. It's definitely usable. Right this morning, I started the documentation for the site. I've been without docs to this day. I wrote some blog stuff that covered a lot of it back in December, but I started and now if you go to yamlscript.org, you'll see a docs link at the top, and it's I started fleshing out the topics and wrote some of the starter doc pages for that. So that should tell you what it's useful for, but I would say we're very close to making a stable V0 release. And I got to explain V0 real quick. So if you've looked at any YAML script code, it starts off with bang YAML script /V0. And that's basically API version 0, because what I knew was that I wouldn't know everything, that I was going to put this code out, people were going to use it, and then I'd want to break it all or break any of it, right? You know, I mean, I'm as serious as Clojure is about backwards compatibility, and I want people to use YAML script now. I don't want to break their code later. So once V0 is called stable, anything that's been written in V0 will continue to work forever. But then I'm free to take the new ideas, which come constantly. Every day or two, I come up with big new ideas, and I'm free to pursue those. I like where I'm going with the language, but, you know, I'll think of ideas that will need some small breaking changes, and I won't have to worry about doing that. Did I answer all the questions? Or?
Yeah. So people can start using it now if there's a binding in their language already.
Right. Or they can use it. They could literally use it to organize their YAML script files. Like, let's say you used a language, you don't, but at work, that had these YAML files in this Bash script and you want to start using it. You could just say YS load your main YAML script file, and it would evaluate that whole thing and produce a final result that you wanted. So maybe you set some environment variable for development or production and that kind of thing. You just run that and it would produce, you could make that a part of your build process.
Right. Like, nice. Mm-hmm.
So the YS loader works regardless of language, right?
Of course. Yeah. So YAML script is sort of, it's closure, but with an extended standard library of sort of different ways to write certain things or some convenience functions. But if I'm a closure programmer, I can take all or almost all of my sort of closure knowledge into writing YAML script.
Yes. And I very purposefully let you, like, I have what's called yes expressions. You've heard of Lisp S expressions, right? I call these yes expressions. And it's just a couple of tricks, but to make it more palatable for people who aren't from a Lisp or closure background. So if you had open paren A to B, say something like that, you could say, close paren, you could say A open paren, the A has to be next to the open paren,
mm-hmm.
to C. So you could take that first, the function, and put it before the paren instead of after it.
Right.
That type of thing, which is what you see in most languages.
Right.
I'll point out right now that commas are white space in YAML script, just like in closure. I love that. You don't need commas at all. You do need them in YAML. So when you're in data mode, you have to use them. But when you're in code mode, you can use them if you want. You don't have to use them. So that's kind of nice.
So today, YAML script is in an unstable V0, hopefully stable V0 coming soon. Do you have a roadmap or things that you know, oh, this has to be in before I mark it stable? Or is it just kind of when you've run out of ideas of things that need to go into the first version?
That's a great question. I've had it in my mind that I want to call it stable. On April 18th, I'm giving a talk at Open Source Summit North America, which happens to be a couple of kilometers from where I live in Seattle. And I would like to present something to say this is stable and then switch over to V1. I might not. My only worry is that the switching over to V1 being at the first time of switching, there's going to be a whole lot to think of that would kind of slow me down a bit. So, like, where do I put all the code such that we have the old code and the new code? And how does that all work together? I don't know. But I would say it's coming in Q2. What Q are we in? Q2, I would say.
Right.
Definitely by mid-winter, as it were. And this is fall for you, isn't it?
Yes.
In New Zealand. So I actually lived down under for a while. So I'm aware of
yeah.
The moon moves in the opposite direction and that kind of thing. Yeah, I think in the next couple of months, we'll have stability on that.
Nice.
I would also point out that I don't have a lot of users yet. So I actually, I got a user of a guy who was using it in anger at work. And he's like, hey, certain mappings, they don't preserve key order. And that's when I learned that, there's this 8-key to 9-key
right.
thing in closure.
Yep.
Where you flip, and all my examples Classic. Were small. So that actually took me 2 days to think about, and now we've resolved it. But and it's actually quite nice. But yeah.
Yeah. So YAML script is interpreted. It's basically a programming language. So you wouldn't expect people to accept sort of untrusted YAML script, I would imagine. I guess I'm curious, have you thought of, is there any way to sort of safely run sort of a minimal YAML script version, or is that too hard? I can't imagine it would be simple.
That's a fantastic question. And as the maintainer of the PyYAML loader, I got really annoyed when people said, we ran this untrusted YAML through it and it did all kinds of bad things. And I'm like, the first line of the documentation says, don't do that. And they said, who reads the documentation? And it turned into this long fight. But I know that's coming, right? So I need to think about it. And I remember now that you were just asking about roadmap. And so one of the things, I have a few points I wrote down for a roadmap. The second point was capabilities, which is the word I just learned. I guess Dino, I think it's pronounced. The D-E-N-O version of Node has this concept of capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I think where YAML script wants to go is that it won't do anything bad if you don't put a bang YAML script at the top, but that's on the user, right? So if they're untrusted, they're going to put that up there.
Mm-hmm.
From the receiver side, I think we should have capabilities, and all capabilities should be turned off without being added. They should be default to being off, so that if you load, you're not going to get any code evaluation from a YAML script loader unless you provide those capabilities. And it should be really easy to turn on capabilities. It should be even different on method call or whatever. But, you know, if you want full YAML, if you want partial, all that stuff should be really easy. But you should also be able to fine tune it down to the method. I know that Babashka, you know, has made a lot of smart defaults, and that's probably a good mode to have as one of the modes, Babashka mode or something like that. But yeah, I know that they've thought a lot about that. But do you really know that Babashka is incapable of being, you know, attacked? Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. So for people who aren't aware, what do capabilities do for you?
Oh, I'm sorry. You were nodding your head and nobody could see that. So capabilities are basically, you are telling the engine what it's allowed to do. You're telling Sci, when I send a piece of YAML script from Python to libYAML script, it's going to compile it, evaluate it, and send me back the return value of the evaluation as JSON. And then when I get that back to Python, I'll decode the JSON and present that as the return value to the call. So with capabilities, you'd also be passing over to Sci, these are the things you're allowed to do. You know, these are your capabilities for this evaluation. If you try to do something outside of those, please throw an error.
Right.
That's how I understand it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's it seems like a pretty powerful feature. So if someone was to say, you know, make a pull request to Kubernetes to switch them to YAML script, is that something you would encourage or support, or like, you know, these large Ansible, there's these sort of very large YAML-based systems. Those feel like pretty interesting places to adopt something like YAML script.
Sure. So I've thought a lot about this, and specifically those two things. I have to say that I'm very aware of Ansible and Kubernetes. I haven't used them in anger in my daily work, but I've actually talked to the heads of those development teams and been involved with them, you know, since the beginning. So Kubernetes currently has a solution for all of the problems in YAML. It's called Helm, right? And it's a templating and composition system. And I looked at it and I'm like, I'm just going to tear this thing apart. It's going to be the devil. And it's, you know, I'm just going to say all these bad things about it. I looked at it and it was pretty well thought out. I couldn't say those bad things. So what I determined was, I think YAML script can still be very useful. The right approach is to make it work with Helm, not replace Helm, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's up to the user what they want to do. And I actually have a talk scheduled in a couple of weeks with an old friend that I used to work with to go over some of his Kubernetes stuff and see if we can. He was kind of an early adopter when I was doing I did a 24-day blog post to advent of YAML script back in December. And that was quite a ride. But he was actually commenting on every day and reading all the posts. And so I'm going to see if he'll help me figure out how well it works with Helm. But, you know, let's take Ansible for an example. Just because Ansible doesn't use YAML script internally doesn't mean a user couldn't very easily do it, right? They could write tooling, or somebody else could write a popular tooling framework that applied YAML script before it got to Ansible. So I think it can fit in well. You don't really want to try to go out and replace the world. You want to make it better.
Yeah. Stepping back a little bit, looking at YAML, you know, YAML was extremely successful data format. I guess XML, JSON are probably the only two comparable ones that come to mind for me. Have you thought about, like, what is it about YAML that, why did it succeed? And what do you think of its legacy now, 20-something years on?
Well, I think it's definitely succeeded, where success means succeeding and making people angry sometimes. But, yeah, no, I think it's useful, and I'm happy with where it's come. I think that maybe it took off. I had this saying when we were developing it. I'm like, I want my mom to be able to understand this language. You know, my mom's not a programmer. And then somebody who was actually high up at MySQL, a friend of mine who was high up at MySQL and Sun and later HP, he's like, I finally get he liked YAML from the get-go, but he's like, I finally realized what's great about YAML. He's like, lawyers can understand it. So, you know, and that's kind of like my mom. My mom's not a lawyer either, but I think it was just, you know, we tried really hard to keep the syntax to a minimum and let the content really shine. And then Clojurians hate that. They want to see, like, where does this data start? Where does this end? What exactly is this, right? Not just Clojurians, but a lot of people, you can't really do both. Well, YAML tries to do both in that it has the flow JSON subset, so you can, but nobody really uses that too much, and they're not supposed to.
Reminds me a little bit of the Björn Stroustrup quote, there's only two kinds of languages, the ones people complain about and the ones nobody uses. And
so many said that exact quote recently. Maybe it was you when we talked a couple of weeks ago. I don't know.
One other thing I forgot to mention before, YAML has a new version, or new as of 1 or 2 years ago, but there's been a sort of updated, I don't know, refinement of the spec, maybe. I'm not quite sure what you would, how you'd define it. But yeah, how did that come about? The previous edition was in 2009 and the current one is 2021. So quite a long time between revisions there.
Yeah, and notice that they're on the exact same day.
I did notice that, October 1st.
Yeah.
I assume that wasn't an accident.
Well, we kind of made that my goal too. It was coming up and I'm like, yeah, we can do this. Yeah, so it almost seems like nobody was thinking about YAML for 12 years. And that's, you know, not the case. I was thinking about it every day, but it's just like, how do you do stuff? And so I kind of built up this core team of 5 people over starting around 2016. I met Tina at a Perl thing in Berlin. Then I picked up Panto from Greece, who had done some really, he's a really heavy C programmer, and he's wrote libfyaml, which is way better than libyaml, but not as popular. And he wanted to do some stuff with the Linux kernel using YAML. So he's been with us ever since. Then we picked up Emily, who's a JavaScript rock star and involved in a lot of high profile projects for Mozilla, I believe. And right in 2021, when we wrote that spec, I noticed this guy, Tom Smith, and asked him if he'd asked all these poignant questions that I had ignored. I just wasn't paying attention. And I'm like, well, this guy knows YAML really well. Let's pull him in if he wants. And he actually did the most work with me. The two of us spent about 3 months at the leading up to that 2021 spec release.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the spec. There is no normative changes from the 2009 spec in that we just wanted to do 2 things. We wanted to show that YAML was still alive and that things were being done with it. And also we wanted to make the spec a lot clearer. So we made, I don't know, 500 commits to the spec probably and automated all these things and really thought about a lot of things and where we might want to go in the future. I think we came up with 60 or so proposals for a future normative change of YAML. And it's really poignant that you asked this question because just last Wednesday, we had the first meeting in quite a while. And we brought up the topic of starting the YAML 1.3 spec. And not only that, we realized that we're all going to be in Europe in 2 weeks. So we're actually going to meet for the first time, all of us, and in person. And we're going to start talking about what might go into a YAML 1.3 spec change, a new one. And I can't really give away any hints because we all at this point just disagree with each other. So, well, you know, there's a lot of ideas. Like I said, there's probably 50 plus ideas of things that could change. One thing that YAML script has really made me realize was that from a language standpoint, I can do everything that I want to do with YAML script with no changes from 1.2, from the current version of YAML. Everything there is I could do. And even if I could change a few things that might make it a little bit nicer, it wouldn't be any big deal for YAML script. So I'm glad that YAML script can sit kind of aside from that I don't have to conflate those two too much.
One thing I pretty well know in YAML flaw problem, I guess, is the Norway problem, or, you know, if you type NO, treat it as false, and sometimes you might have meant that to be Norway instead of, you know, the country code Norway. But what I think is less well known about that is that was actually fixed in 2009, I think, with the 1.2 revision. But, you know, we're 2024, of course, and, you know, people are still sort of complaining about the Norway problem today, which I guess I assume means that a lot of YAML loaders are using an older version of the YAML spec. Is that correct? Or
yes. Here's what really happened. I mean, we wrote a spec and it was extremely complicated and detailed, and it was definitely a lot of credit to Oren for getting all that work done, basically encapsulating everything we talked about over years and doing a pretty good job of it. But I don't think nearly anybody followed the spec only to implement YAML. What they did was, so there's a guy, Kirill, he wrote the original PyYAML and then he ported it to C. You'd think he did it the other way around, but he actually wrote the first version as PyYAML, ported that to C, and that's libyaml.
Right.
So they're very close in what they do. And he also disagreed with the spec and he's like, oh, that's nonsense. I'm not going to do that. So that was problematic. And then an easy way to make an YAML implementation is just do a binding to libyaml. And if you don't want to do a binding, the next easiest way is to just copy libyaml or pyyaml. Mm-hmm. And they're both very good implementations. I mean, and they're very well thought out according to the spec. They have all the stages. You can hook into the different stages. Very flexible. LibYAML and PyYAML have not been brought up. They're things that, you know, we keep saying we're going to do. Our core team is, because we actually, he gave them to me, and Tina and I are responsible for those. But, it, you know, a lot of work to get those up to 1.2, and nobody's using the spec. They're just, you know, copying off of each other. It's kind of a terrible thing.
And there is a test suite of how to properly interpret YAML. So I guess everyone listening should ask for a 1.2 version of YAML rather than 1.1, if possible.
That test suite thing just came up today. Some guy just a couple hours ago dropped by. I mean, it's not like we get a lot of traffic on the YAML forum, but he's like, hey, I'm writing a YAML implementation for Delphi. I'm like, okay. And he's like, and I have some questions on the test suite. I'm like, well, you're starting in the right place. So good on you for that.
Nice. Yeah, that must be satisfying. All right. Is there any other YAML or YAML script related things that we haven't talked about that you wanted to cover?
There's dozens, but I'd have to read my list here. I want to give my tip of the hat. Nobody could see that but you, but I'm actually wearing a hat. To Rich Hickey for making Closure. I also want to know how he made it so popular. I have no idea. If you know, please tell me offline. Because I know that things don't just magically come popular because you create great things. It's takes a lot of work and a lot of luck. But the main thing that he did there was he took an existing language that he had worked with that was full-featured with all the external libraries, and he built something over that. And that's the way you kind of have to create a new language these days. And going down the Lingi route, I was still 2 years out for getting a closer working in Perl, at least. You know, that was going to take forever. But I found the right pieces where I'm like, oh, closer's already built. I'm just going to write a thing over that works in YAML and for YAML. Mm-hmm. And that can be done in 3 weeks, you know, and, you know, 8 months later, it's like still working on it. But yeah, it's great because you're just building on the shoulders of giants, right? I'm building over Closer, and hopefully eventually people look under the sheets and go, oh, I need to learn more Closer and come back. I hope that happens. And hopefully at that point, the Closer community doesn't get really mad at me because I've pointed all these YAML people at the Closer community. You know, that's another worry I have. It's like, they're like, we don't allow YAML script people here. Get out. I don't think that would happen.
I don't think so. I think that would be a good problem to have if we had.
That would be a great problem to have.
Influx of new users wanting to learn Closure. Yeah. So you've given several talks about YAML script online. You've got another one coming up. So I'll have links to those in the show notes if people want to do it. And one other thing which I thought was creative, and I haven't really seen this very often, is you've got a way to install YAML script temporarily. So install it just for the current shell session, but without installing anything permanently, which is nice if people want to try it out without making any changes to their overall system.
When you call yourself a bash expert, you have to, like, those things just kind of pop into mind, right? So it's like, in order for something to work in the current shell, you have to source it, not run it, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it creates a new process. So I'm like, hey, what if I just source this curl instead of running it as a different process? Then I could actually just install it into a temporary directory and set the path, because I'm sourcing, I can set the path for the current shell. And that's basically what happens. You know, it just puts it in the temp directory. It doesn't even delete it because it can't really successfully trap that. Maybe it could, I don't know. Anyway, eventually it gets deleted.
Yeah. So is there anyone you'd like to thank or mention who's been helpful in creating YAML script?
Yeah, just a few people I'd like to mention. Again, Peter Stromberg for pulling me into the Closure community and opening up my eyes. My friend Ruben, who I met during that Perl conference, and he just pointed me at GraalVM and that kind of stuff. Probably the person that I work with the most is a guy named Ven, who's worked on a lot of different, he's a polyglot. I don't even think he's 30 years old, but he's a polyglot that I've known for like 12 years. He did a lot of work on CoffeeScript, did a lot of work on Perl 6. You know, I've seen him around. He's just brilliant. And I run everything I do in YAML script by him. He's very encouraging. And a couple of times he said, that's a terrible idea. I'm like, no, it's not. And then I realized 2 days, I'm like, oh yeah, that was a terrible idea. So he's wonderful. Thank you, Van. In the Closurian Slack, of course, Michael Borkent is He invented Psy. He answers all these questions. I'm sure he's sick of me by now, but I want to thank you very much, Michael, for all the help you've given me. And I hope it somehow pays you back and that I can do things that apply to both YAMLScript and Babashka in the future. Delon Newman is the guy who, from the Clojurient Slack, who's actually written 3 bindings and threatened to write more, except he's moving across country this month and unable to sit at a computer to do it. But when he's back, I'm sure he'll be contributing more. My friend Tony wrote the Raku, which is the new name for Perl 6 thing. And, you know, he's just a friend of mine. And he's like, yeah, I'll do that one. And then I met a guy named JJ. I just asked my friend Olaf. I'm like, who do I get for Perl? I don't have time to do this. And he's like, contact this guy from England. And he did it. And he's, you know, anyway, so I'm probably going to leave off a few names there. But yeah, I'm trying to involve as many people as interested. If anybody stops by, if you have a thing you'd like to see implemented, I'm just going to make you a team member. Because to me, the most fun is working with other people. So
great. Yeah. I mean, there's still, looks like Elixir, D, Julia, a few others. They're still, you know, ready for someone to jump on, own those bindings if anyone knows.
Oh, right.
Some obscure.
Those are the placeholder bindings. I actually got, like, right away, I'm like, ooh, some of these things you have to be the first one to
right.
Name the name.
Grab the name. So,
yeah. But now there's, I have a list of, I always say 42 languages, but it's, you know, I'm going to get at least 42 languages for YAMLScript. Fortran is my next big one, which sounds crazy, but when I wrote that PST, I was just writing a wrapper around other package managers, and Fortran blew me away by having a top-notch, it's totally modern, make everybody jealous package manager. And I'm like, well, surely they wrote it all in Fortran, which is just insane to me.
Nice.
And yeah, so I think Fortran will be the next one.
And is there a YAML for Fortran? Looks like there is.
Yes. And so, yeah, and I also noticed that there was a YAML for Fortran, right?
Right.
So, and it used libyaml, so I know it does FFI bindings, or it does some kind of calling out to a shared library. So, yeah, that's, I kind of did my homework on that one. Yeah.
Nice. So we have YAML running on mainframes all around the world.
Right. Controlling a YAML strip, controlling interplanetary travel. What could go wrong?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for creating YAMLScript and YAML as well. You know, these are two. Well, one is already very popular. Hopefully the second will also become very popular in time. And yeah, thanks for, I guess, all of your open source work. Clojure community, YAML community, Perl community. I'm probably missing probably a dozen other communities that you've contributed to over a very long career. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank you personally for offering me this podcast back in October, I think, and then being patient with me while I put it off. I almost wanted to put it off this morning because I'm like, oh, there's some more I could get done before this thing. And I feel so nervous. But it's been wonderful talking to you, and I really appreciate you.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. And I'll make sure to check out the next talk.
Sounds great.